right. It is 5:31, so we're going to call to order the City Council work session for May 26, 2026. So I'll call this meeting to order, and then we'll start with topics of discussion number one, comprehensive plan update. Turn it over to Todd.
Thank you, Mayor, Council members. All right, it is time to start talking about the 2050 Comprehensive Plan update. So with that, I have a few slides here and just kind of walking through with some kind of basic intro stuff to those of you who weren't on council 10 years ago or on a commission or worked on these before. But the comprehensive plan is basically your guiding policy document for anything related to land use, infrastructure, utilities, transportation. It's basically what we're trying to implement over the next 20 years. Where do we want to go as a community? And that you should be thinking about it in most of the decisions that you as policymakers make. So it is something that is required by state statute. The Metropolitan Council coordinates it. I'll talk a little bit more about that in the upcoming slides. These are 20-year documents. They're done every 10 years, and within that 20 years, there is essentially a 10-year check-in point. So you can't just say, we're going to get to it in 19 and a half years. You're supposed to kind of be working along, have some milestones, some check-in points, knowing that you can't magically make everything appear at once, but work your way towards something. And then they're updated every 10 years at the same time as everybody else, and that is for coordination. The Met Council facilitates that, but it's really us to work with our neighbors and figure out what they want to do, what we want to do, so things line up. Roads line up. We're not planning something on our side of the line that the community on the other side of the line is going to have a problem with, or the other way around. So within that comprehensive plan, there are 10 things that are required. We often think about land use as being the big one, but the land use does drive a lot of the other sections, but it's not the only one in there. A lot of communities that are built out and don't really have much opportunity for redevelopment, they still need to look at all of their older systems and plan for it. All right. So here is the map of the Seven County metro area that the Met Council oversees the comp plan process for. They coordinate over 150 different communities, all the counties, as well as the townships have to do all this at the same time. So we're just a little speck in this broad area, but what we do impacts our neighbors, and what they do impact us. What the Met Council does is they look at things at this big picture. They look at growth trends, submarkets, where are things growing, where's the demand, where are jobs going, where are the big roads, and what does that facilitate land use actions and things like that. And they basically look at, okay, the region's going to grow as a whole this much, and then what is each community's their share of that regional growth, population as well as employment, based on a bunch of different factors that are at a bigger level than just the city. So what they do is they try to simplify it a little bit and have broken up the region into 8 different categories. And Ramsey is identified as a suburban edge. I didn't include the description, but I think the write-up describes Ramsey quite well with that. And then within each of those 8 districts or designations, they have various policy statements and things that the cities need to, and townships and counties need to work towards. And with that, you know, they run their sewer systems in the region. And what they want to do with this massive investment is just make sure that they're providing capacity in the growing places or the places that will grow a little bit further out. Then those investments will come later. They, like the council does, wants to get a good return on its investment. So that's one of the reasons why we're doing this, so knowing that the pipes aren't going to be a lot of money to spend for very little use. Another component is transportation. Every community is divided up into little pockets that are called TAZs, or traffic analysis zones. And within that, there's a set of land use assumptions that get equated into traffic numbers. How many cars, how many trucks, what kind of freight. So that way it helps with transportation planning. Highway 10, all that planning over the years use this sort of data to see who's growing and what's it going to need to be, and then help spend money in the places that it's going to need it the most next. So the 2040 plan that was done 10 years ago, in my opinion, Stephanie's as well, it was a pretty good plan. I have a lot of nice stuff written up in there. There are some things, though, that do need to get updated with the next set of numbers. And those set of numbers come from what's called the system statement. One of the things that Met Council is supposed to do as part of that state law is look at the big picture and figure out what each community needs to have. And this is, in a way, it's a checklist for every community of the different elements that we need to have. There are a lot of things that are just really not applicable, like airport protections. You know, we don't have one anymore. We don't have one close enough that it's an impact. So what everyone likes to focus in on are the numbers. So the things that really get tailored down to each community are the population, the actual residents, the households, and then the employment numbers, as well as our allocation of affordable housing. So with a lot of this stuff, we can certainly do some of the stuff in-house, but these are five things that are required that we just can't do. We don't have the technical expertise to do it. We don't have the software to do it. Pretty much no city has that. So we will need to hire some consultants for that. And we've put that in our budget request for it. Well, with that budget request, one of the first opportunities that we have is that the Met Council we could get a $40,000 grant from them because we meet certain criteria to be eligible for a grant. They've done this in previous comp plan cycles, and that's something that we need to see if the council would like us to pursue. All these consulting services will cost more than that. But what we were hoping to do with your feedback is work on this later on this fall, put together some more structured meeting outlines with our boards and commissions, and then progress some things so that we can start engaging consultants to take the numbers and things that we come up with the work that we can do in-house, send it off to them, do their analysis, come back sometime in the summer of 27, kind of put it all together, and then we do have to have a public hearing. The Planning Commission would host that, we're thinking sometime in late 27. Once we've had that public hearing, then we have to release it to our adjacent affected community. So it's basically everyone around us, the school district, and the county, both Anoka and Hennepin County, since they border us, they get 6 months to review it to make sure that what we're working on jives with what they're working on the other way around. Most the unwritten rule with planners is, let's not take 6 months. Let's try and get these done in a month or two. Review them. So that way we're not holding each other up. And then at some point, the council will then pass a resolution to submit this document to the Met Council. And what we're shooting for is that in September, because on October 10th, another part of that grant request is we can get some bonus money for an early submittal. We have it done, submitted to them by the 10th of October. Otherwise, we have to get it by December 31st of 2018.
Yeah, and that incentive is another $4,000 that we can get from them as long as we have it submitted by October 10th.
So that grant application, that was something that just was released today, or at least we discovered it today, so it wasn't in the packet. But do you want us to ask to be $40,000? If so, we just need to throw a resolution on to the next or upcoming council agenda for it.
$40,000 grant?
Yep.
Good.
All right. So then the next two ones we probably want to discuss a little bit more. How do you want to be involved in this? There's different chapters, those required elements that seem to line up very well with what our various boards and commissions do. And I'm sure they could kind of narrow in on their parts very easily. But do you want to be involved as the seven of you throughout that process? Do you just want to let the liaisons deal with it and then bring it back? Brian will tell us that the next whole bunch of work sessions are going to be full of budget discussions, so we're not really going to have an ability to do much at this meeting. Our abilities are going to be much stronger at the various boards and commission meetings.
I have something to add as well.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about the other groups that are going to be involved with it, you know, there's things that Todd mentioned, you know, for example, the transportation plan. I mean, we have to have those traffic analysis zones updated. There's things like that that have to be updated, and those numbers are going to be those numbers. The sewer portion, I mean, that data that we have to collect, that data is going to be that data. It's not going to change. It's not like there's much discussion at that. But I think what we're looking more of is like the land use portion of it, where Planning Commission is very much going to be involved with that and looking at the housing and zoning and land uses and that sort of thing. You know, how does council want to be involved in that? You know, is that something that we take to Planning Commission first and then it comes to council, or do we have group work sessions just to ensure everybody's on the same page with it? So we're looking more direction on those bigger components.
Input from the council? Chris?
Well, last time that I went through this, the group of us, council, I kind of felt like it was more, let's get through it as kind of not just as quickly, but as easily, cheaply as we can. And there's good reasons for that. However, looking back, I think we made mistakes or didn't realize a lot of the decisions that we were making when all of a sudden we're like, oh, we want to do something different. Now we need a comp plan amendment. I wish we would have thought better about that earlier. So I would suggest that as a council, we are more involved and keep our head in the game. I mean, obviously, we want to get it done as quickly and efficiently as we can, but keep our head in the game. And I would ask staff to make sure, point out, here are specific decision-making points that you're about to make a decision, and this is what it means, it, not just we think it all makes sense, let's go ahead. But we need to understand what are these decisions mean, and what are they going to mean in 8 years and 10 years when we're like, oh, someone wants to do something that we didn't think was going to happen, and now that's going to cause a big problem, and we got to go through all the amendment. So I think council should be more intimately involved, asking staff to point out decision-making, whatever, points. But also, I think it's real important that we do utilize our boards and commissions, I mean, especially like, you know, planning. I mean, that's what they're good at. They know more about that stuff than we do, and so we should allow them to use their expertise.
Michael?
Hey, sir. I agree with everything you say, and from a logistics, practical standpoint, I think I would lean towards leaning heavily on the various commissions to do the deep discussions and hard work, and if necessary, because we're in budget sessions or whatever, have a maybe special council meeting where all that stuff is kind of distilled down to here are the important points we've come up with, and enough data and material behind that so that we can actually study it and make good choices.
Other thoughts? Yeah, I would echo that, but I would also say, you know, I think one of the big things is the zoning side of things. I know a lot of people got elected talking about how we're going to maintain the more rural areas, and we have to flex, we have to meet the Met Council on density requirements, and where is the best place to rezone, and how does that affect the residents. So I think a lot of the stuff, the minutia, like where are roads going, and where are intersections and traffic studies, I think that's more is what it is. Like you said, like traffic is a number that's not going to change, but for the items that might impact residents more, like where we're going to increase zoning, where we're going to what we're going to designate for expansion, I think that's going to be pretty important for us. So I'd echo what Chris said, and maybe and Michael, maybe do a couple work sessions as we kind of hit those inflection points on go or no go, or which direction do we want, and then to involve the commissions, I think doing a joint council meeting with some of the planning commissioners or things of that nature might work. I think, as Chris said, this is a big lift, and we owe it to the residents to do it well. So I personally feel like a couple additional meetings to do that is warranted, versus just signing off on something at the end. So, yes.
Mayor and council members, so when we go into the land use, because we do know that's going to be a very heavy portion, and that those land use categories, those lines may switch, and you may have to bring in other land and take out land. We don't know what that's going to look like right now. Does council envision having joint work sessions with planning commission when we start talking about that heavy stuff? Maybe, like you were saying, a couple extra meetings or something where it's actually joint planning commission, city council meetings, go through those parts of the comp plan?
I would think so.
Okay.
Yeah. Anything else on this one? Council involvement?
Do you want those meetings to be something scheduled, or take advantage of the calendar that we have? When we're thinking of some of these more heavier discussions, are actually going to be more the lighter agendas at the Planning Commission.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing would have to be a different schedule. It's just you, would, as the council, would show up on a different date.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
Good. Sounds like to me that it may be better to have separate meeting with the Planning Commission and City Council out of a Planning Commission meeting, just because these could be meetings that do run a little bit longer where we need more time, want more ideas and such. So
yeah,
that would be my recommendation. Hold them separate from like a council work session or regular Planning Commission meeting.
Yeah, I would say based on, I would say, anyway, you guys say, leave it up to the staff to decide when the best time is. If there's a very small agenda for a working or for a planning commission meeting, if we do it before that and after that. Otherwise, if it's just adding another Tuesday in between council meetings, I think that's probably fine too. But I think that we can leave up to you guys to navigate. We don't want to take away from the council work session as we go to budgeting, but we can be creative outside of that. That'd be fine.
We're a few months off, so
yeah. Okay.
Then lastly, public engagement. There are some communities that want to take their comprehensive plan and do a lot of visioning and community engagement where they want to do a lot of redevelopment, big massive changes. We're just kind of taking the just tweak what needs to be tweaked approach, but if council wants to use this document to be something bigger and get more residents behind it and shape whatever vision might come out of that, we can do it that way too. We're promised to have that we could have a one night at least at the farmers market, the rotating table. Mm-hmm. So that's something. Could we do? Do you want open houses? Do you want neighborhood meetings?
Stephanie?
I do envision at least one public engagement where we do have an open house here at City Hall, probably in the Alexander Ramsey room, where it is just open. Once we get it down a little bit.
Yeah.
More, you know, just for the public to come in and take a look at it and provide comments before we do public hearing. So that's something that we will schedule.
Yeah, I think the scope of change would probably dictate how much. I mean, public engagement's great no matter what. But if we are tweaking a couple things, maybe it's one night open house in the farmer's market. If there's going to be some huge changes, it's going to affect the community, and we've discovered that later on. Maybe we increase that, but...
When it comes to engagement, Mayor, do you want the engagement to help fuel your decisions for change or be something that's responsive to any sort of proposal?
Thoughts from the council?
I think almost both, but I mean, you have something kind of prepared, then I guess based on feedback, if things need to be changed universally or something.
Yeah, it's hard to answer because we have to make decisions just for the community as elected representatives. So we can't always put the wagon before the horse, but we do want to consider things that we may overlook and valuable input that the residents might have. So I don't know, maybe you can come back with some ideas of what that would look like, proactive versus retroactive, us going out and soliciting information, incorporate versus us making decisions and then listening to feedback and adjusting. Does that answer your question?
When you're out talking to constituents, if you hear buzz about something, you could just say, it sounds like a good reason to put together a meeting on that topic.
Sure. Okay. Go on that one?
I'm good with that.
Is that it?
That's it for the presentation. If there's any burning questions that you have on comp plan now that we can sort of talk about. We don't want to get too deep into the weeds on anything. Kind of let that come later on.
Okay. Chris?
Well, I mean, I would just think as a general rule, we want to push the boundaries of what Met Council thinks they want. I would want to make sure that we're meeting an overall, not specific property by property, as we've been doing and following. But I mean, that council in general doesn't seem to reflect what the citizens of Ramsey want. So I would think that we want to be as pushing the boundary and edges of what Ramsey wants versus what that council wants.
Anyone else? I would concur. Any other questions about the strategic plan or the comprehensive plan? Any lingering questions based on the presentation to ask before we move on? All right.
Thank you.
So fast, so easy. All right. On to 2.2, wage theft enforcement. I'm going to turn this one over to Councilmember Buescher. We do have some guests here. During the work session, there's some flexibility. So in the interest of time, I'm thinking, Councilmember Buescher, if you want to introduce this, go over your presentation, and then we can invite anyone that wants to speak or a representative from their group wants to speak, and then keep it around 5 minutes just to answer any questions or simplify anything that was said. I think that 5 minutes would be appropriate amount of time to fill in any blanks.
So I did invite the folks here tonight to be presenters, so I'll be requesting more than 5 minutes of their time because they will be the ones that are going to share the bulk of what I'm bringing to you today, seconded by Council Member Peters. So there'll be a conversation about wage theft enforcement as well as project labor agreement policy. I'll have the guys stand up and introduce themselves, and they can decide who goes first.
We're going to do a quick point of order on this one. So for the work session, outside organizations presenting to the council, is there a time limit on that? How do we want to make sure that they're heard without going over?
Mayor, I would say historically it's been a little bit more lax than at the regular meeting, just as far as like the citizens forum, things of that nature. I would say if resident expert would be a fair way to explain it, if they're kind of the ones with the information, the knowledge, and more of the background versus an individual council member. I think in the past it's been allowed for a guest to speak a little bit longer, but
okay.
Ultimately it's the council as a whole, and you as running the meeting, and then the council as a whole as far as when to give consensus direction, etc.
Okay. So we have about an hour. Is that enough time to present on both cases? Okay. So as long as that's good, then we can turn it over back over to Councilmember Buescher, and you can introduce your guests.
All right, fellas. Go ahead. Tim, you want to start?
I'll start. Yeah, we'll just go down the row and introduce ourselves. My name is Anthony Wilkie. I'm the Government Affairs Representative for Sheet Metal Workers, Smart Bubble 10 here in the Metro.
I'm Matt Urban. I'm the business agent for the Sprinkler Fitters and Fire Protection for the 417 local.
Hi, I'm Paul Martin. I'm with the Sheet Metal Workers as well, a representative. My name is Woodrow Piner. I'm with the Carpenters Union, based out of St. Paul.
I'm Tim Watkins, Education and Policy Coordinator and a Compliance Investigator with the Fair Contracting Foundation, Minnesota.
And my name is Dylan Rangeloff. I'm with the Boilermakers, Local 647. I'm the Apprenticeship Coordinator. We're located just up Highway 10.
All right, thank you.
So, how do you guys usually do this? Just like testimony?
You can just grab a seat there and then.
Yeah, great. thank you very much for your time, first and foremost. Like I said, I'm Anthony Wilkie. I represent Sheet Metal Workers. We have a three-state radius from Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. The reason that's significant is because the largest part of our density is right here in Anoka County, where we've got about 2,000 members, and just under 400 of them living right here in Ramsey, which, when you consider the size of the city and that amount of sheet metal workers, it's a pretty good ratio. To get into my work here, on April 27, 2025, the state of Minnesota resolved its largest wage theft case to date. It was an audit of the projects involving labor brokerage firms, PMC, and Property Maintenance LLC. The investigations will collect $1.28 million in wage theft violations. And while the state originally sought to recover $2.4 million in back pay, it still reveals an ongoing harm of workers and communities that stem from worker misclassification and bad actors in the construction space. The U.S. Department of Labor defines wage theft as a failure to pay wages or provide employee benefits owed to an employee by contract or by law. Aside from outright denial of pay or no expulsion, commonly in construction we see this theft stem from misclassification. As of March 1st, 2025, Minnesota has a 14-factor test to determine if an employee is an independent contractor or not. The impact of this is that labor brokerage firms generally don't commit to oversight to these criteria, leaving both the worker and the state at the risk of being defrauded. Minnesota's own wage theft law on the books since 2018 created a framework in which to prosecute offenders. However, the mechanism for enforcement and investigating becomes ever more nebulous in today's labor market. A lot of this gets exacerbated by, you know, cash apps and a lot of, like, under-the-table work. The Department of Labor estimates roughly 20% of construction work in this country gets done by cash, where there is no way to pay into fringes, unemployment benefits in the state of Minnesota are in sick and safe time, and the insurance infrastructure of the state itself. also including payroll taxes. Wage theft in construction harms workers first by reducing pay, overtime benefits, and access to protections such as workers' compensation and unemployment insurance, but this also distorts competition by allowing non-compliant contractors to underbid responsible firms, shifting pressure across the market. For project owners and general contractors, wage theft can trigger legal exposure, delays, reputational damage, costly disputes within the subcontracting chain. But more broadly, it reduces tax revenues and weakens trust in the industry by rewarding practices that rely on misclassification, off-the-books payments, and payroll fraud. Along with misclassification and wage theft, this unregulated labor chain also becomes susceptible to labor trafficking. As defined by U.S. statute, labor trafficking is a form of modern-day slavery which individuals are recruited, harbored, transported, provided, or obtained for labor or services through the use of force, fraud, or coercion, within the purpose of subjugating them to involuntary servitude. In these most horrific cases, the worker, without proper channels of resource, can find themselves in a cycle where there is nowhere to return, to find any protections. The Minnesota Department of Public Safety lists construction a list of the most trafficked jobs. Outside of labor trafficking, these same brokerage firms often fill spots with workers from far outside the local communities where these developments are happening. As a construction worker personally, I'm all for somebody earning a living. However, as a representative for roughly 2,000 sheet metal workers here in the area and a few more hundred in this municipality alone, not utilizing the skilled trade folks within your own community and replenishing that into the local tax base is a complete miss. In short, without a systematic check to labor trafficking and wage theft, the burden is left to citizens of the community and the tax infrastructure of the municipality itself. As this problem is systematic, it becomes a responsibility of municipalities to make sure that they are protecting their communities and ultimately the taxpayer when taxpayer money is potentially involved in a project. Whether the mechanism is TIF or a bonding measure or a levy, there is an obligation to be stewards of the taxpayer's investment into their community. Examples of wage theft divisions have popped up all over the metro, and these task forces will become more necessary to protect the safety of local jobs and taxpayer dollars as we encounter more development in communities surrounding the traditional Twin Cities metro census area. And this is kind of the crux of our argument today, is that as we're seeing development kind of go beyond the first and second ring communities of the metro area, we're seeing a lot of development. We're seeing a lot of development from contractors who have a history of neglecting these practices and not practicing above board. We see when there is TIF involved and when there's bonding measures involved, we see a lot of misappropriation of taxpayer money. When you consider the waste, fraud, and abuse discussions going on in the state of Minnesota recently, this is one of the first places the rubber can really hit the road. With that, I'm going to keep it brief because there are a lot of people here, but if you have any questions for me, I'm happy to take them.
Do you just want to maybe mention some of the names in that lawsuit for the construction companies?
The one that was settled in Viking Lakes?
Yes.
Yeah, it was PMC, Property Maintenance, LLC. They were all labor brokerage firms. Yellow Tree, I believe, was also investigated. But one of my colleagues from the other trades actually might be able to speak about it a little bit better.
Thank you.
Yeah. Anyone else? Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. All right. Good evening, Mayor Heineman and council members and city staff. Thank you for the opportunity to address this evening's work session. As I mentioned earlier, my name is Tim Watkins, and I'm Education and Policy Coordinator, as well as a Compliance Investigator with the Fair Contracting Foundation of Minnesota. We are a nonprofit construction compliance monitor representing the more than 70,000 men and women of Minnesota's building trades, as well as more than 2,100 signatory contractors. Really appreciate the city's interest in protecting workers and legitimate businesses by fighting wage theft and other forms of fraud on taxpayer-supported projects. As you all know, governments are obligated to award publicly funded contracts to the lowest responsible bidder, which creates this temptation for contractors to cut corners if they don't think anyone is watching. And unfortunately, such low-road business practices are all too prevalent in the construction industry, as evidenced by the cases that Tony just mentioned with the Viking Lakes, as well as I believe it was 18 other projects over a three-year period where some 26 workers were defrauded out of tens of thousands of dollars each. It was the single largest wage recovery in DLI's history. But I also want to share another case that has recently come up. Just on May 7th, the Ramsey County Attorney's Office announced that they were bringing charges against a company called Limanese Remodeling, who had engaged in workers' compensation fraud to the tune of about $180,000 on a St. Paul public housing project. And these charges that were just announced a couple weeks ago are in addition to previous charges, which were announced just back in September against a contractor for wage theft and tax fraud brought against a different sub but had worked on an earlier phase of that same project. So the point of this is that these cases clearly demonstrate that fraudulent business practices of worker independent contractor misclassification, payroll fraud, and wage theft can occur on any sort of project, even high-profile private developments and publicly funded projects. So there's not really any area of the industry that is 100% safe from these sort of practices taking root. And in fact, a 2021 report by the Midwest Economic Policy Institute found that approximately 23% of Minnesota construction workers are either misclassified as independent contractors or paid off the books entirely. So nearly a quarter of the workforce in this state. This reduces worker wages and benefits by approximately $23,000 per year, as well as reduces tax revenues for social insurance and safety net programs to the tune of about $136 million a year, putting more of that burden onto lawful employers who actually pay their taxes, as well as taxpayers. So, unfortunately, unscrupulous contractors take advantage of public low bidding requirements to shortchange workers and undercut lawful employers who are doing things the right way, profiting only themselves at the expense of everyone else. Now, understanding that the city of Ramsey cannot solve this problem alone, but I do want to note that there are some proactive measures that the city could choose to take to ensure that investments of city dollars, at least, do not unintentionally subsidize this exploitation and these fraudulent business practices. So there's a variety of different policy options that you can consider, things like apprenticeship utilization requirements, responsible bidder policies that go above and beyond the Minnesota Responsible Contractor Law, prevailing wage requirements, project labor agreements, or community benefit agreements. These, again, a menu of different options to help ensure that city-funded projects are being awarded to law-abiding contractors who are actually going to do the right thing and provide benefit to the community. So the point is that policy ideas such as these have been around for a long time, so the city does not need to recreate the wheel in considering how to better prevent fraud on city-funded projects. And last, I do just want to give a shout-out. It's not this body, but the Anoka County Attorney's Office just recently sent, I believe, three representatives to last week's meeting of the Labor Advisory Council. And if you're not familiar with that entity, that was a joint effort spearheaded by the county attorneys for Hennepin and Ramsey in coordination with a number of other state agencies, such as DLI, Attorney General, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, Department of Administration, Department of Health, Human Services, again, variety of different agencies who have all been coordinating with one another over the last few years to try and share information and resources to drive investigations and prosecutions of wage theft and labor trafficking in the Twin Cities Metro. So really want to commend the county attorney here for coming there and was very vocal about wanting to participate and engage more with that network. So there are other efforts already underway to address these things. It's just there's because each different municipality controls its own suite of money, there's always the potential that these problems could emerge, in these different municipalities. So, again, just wanted to share some of this information to drive home that this is, in fact, a real problem. We're not here just spinning our wheels or to waste your time, but because we see the systemic impact of these practices within our industry and wanting to ensure that the commitments of city dollars to public projects aren't also unintentionally fueling that abuse and exploitation. So thank you all for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Kristen?
Do you want to just review the tools in our tool belt that we can use, the apprenticeship model all the way through community benefit, and how we would enforce that or what kind of efforts behind our city would have to do that to enforce that?
Oh, yeah. So, again, there's a variety of different ones that all kind of work a little bit differently. Apprenticeship utilization is pretty straightforward. It just contractors verify that they participate in either a USDOL or a State Department of Labor-approved apprenticeship program, so that they are, in fact, providing real, meaningful training and not just, trying to get a check off on their taxes or things like that. So that information is pretty easily accessible. That one's pretty straightforward. It's just a yes or no, do you actually have a legitimate program or not? Responsible bidder policies, that's kind of one of the most flexible ones. These policies have been used in a lot of other states like Indiana and Michigan and Wisconsin, less so in Minnesota because we do have a state responsible contractor law, but that Importantly, the state law only sets the floor. It doesn't set a cap on what those requirements could be to be considered responsible and therefore allowed to bid on, bid on public projects. Oftentimes, apprenticeship requirements are a part of responsible bidder ordinances. Prevailing wages are just simply setting the wage standard in place based on wages that are already paid in the community here. So every year, the Department of Labor assesses what contractors are actually paying for various scopes of work in Anoka County and in all 86 other counties in Minnesota. And then based on those survey responses of the industry, they set those wages for each of those communities. So again, it is that's essentially setting kind of like a minimum wage, but specifically for construction. And again, it is based off of work that has actually been taken place within those communities within the last 12 months. Project labor agreements are essentially a pre-hire agreement specifying like how workers will be, how labor force will be obtained, like benefits and things like that, and training requirements. And it also can include things like local hire preferences, like you must have so many workers from the local area and things like that. So again, there's a lot of variety here, and we'd be more than happy to share with council some examples of some of these different policies if you'd like to see ideas of that. But the point what I wanted to convey was that there's a lot of flexibility and a lot of optionality in terms of how you go about addressing these sorts of things. So I just kind of wanted to lay out the menu and then be happy to provide more detail about any of those that might be of interest to this body.
Is prevailing wage, is that based on all work done or work done by unions?
It is based on survey response. So the Department of Labor has their database of all the companies that are registered from the sole proprietorship guy in a truck sort of outfits all the way up to the big general contractors. They notify everyone who is registered as a contractor that it's time to submit surveys, and it is a voluntary process. So it is contractors that choose to submit surveys saying, where did they perform work, what type of work was it, and then what was the wage and benefit package that they pay. And then the state takes all of those responses, and then they use the mode in statistics for assessing, like if you get 10 surveys, then you use the one that appeared most frequently in that data set. So it's based on a mix of union and non-union contractors.
Shannon, did I see your hand up?
Yeah, I'm just like, do we have a sheet of paper that's going around with... Like, I obviously don't think we do, but you're spitting out so much so fast. I'm just, like, not able to keep up with these new terms and everything else. So can we get furnished a list of these four pieces that we currently have as tools?
I think there's community benefit engagement as well.
Community benefit engagement.
Okay,
yep.
See?
We could send you some information, kind of some primers on each of those. Again, if you really want to go down the rabbit hole, you could find lots of studies examining each of them in detail, but we can provide some basic info about how they work.
Okay. Kirsten in the channel.
So all of these, because they're flexible, it could be put in place and non-union shops can bid.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, there's nothing that precludes shops from participating on any of those projects or submitting bids.
Yeah. And I lost my question. Hold on. What do we currently have going on in the city of Ramsey? These are our current tools. What is city of Ramsey currently using, or are we not using any of these tools? Or
sure. Mayor, Councilmember Stewart, so it depends on the funding behind. I'll speak to our own city projects first. So on our own city projects, whenever there's state or federal dollars helping pay for the project, we have to meet at least the prevailing wage requirement. Not so much, Bruce, correct me if I'm wrong, but not so much any of the other resources listed here. If we provide public, like city dollars to a project, we don't require any of this. So they just go through the bidding process, and ultimately it's up to the general contractor and the owner of the project to monitor it themselves. The city is not doing any checks and balances. Back to a city project where we do have to do at least the prevailing wage deal, we are checking weekly or biweekly payrolls. We are doing some type of audits because we ultimately have to then turn that info into the states or whoever's auditing our work that we actually met the grant requirements.
Right. Thank you.
If I can could add just one note on. And yes. Typically when it's state or federal dollars, in many cases the municipality recipient's obligation is just to collect the records and make sure they're, you know, received in a timely fashion and whatnot. So in many cases the reviewing of payroll records and things like that is almost an optional kind of thing, unless the city has its own enforcement staff. But it's really about the collecting of the records and just making sure that they're publicly accessible. It's like the baseline kind of state and federal requirement.
Okay. Kristen?
So you would say that stereotypically to enforce any of these five things, that would save us money. We wouldn't be putting a lot extra out in time or money as a city.
There's been a lot of research looking at the cost impact of these various policies, specifically the primary focus on prevailing wage and project labor agreements, and when researchers from across the country have looked into those, where they compare baskets of projects that had prevailing wage against baskets of projects that did not, they found that there is no cost difference. Similarly, there was a recent study published like in the Port of Seattle where they had adopted project labor agreement requirements in mid-2010s, sometime, I don't remember the exact year, but then they were able to look at their projects beforehand and the ones afterwards. They were all port-owned, and then they were able to kind of see whether there was a change between when the projects took place, and they found, again, that there was no difference there in terms of project cost or whatnot. So, again, a lot of that research that examines prevailing wage or project labor and those in that level of detail, they're comparing project level data. So you're looking at suites of highway projects or K-12 school projects or affordable housing projects and then comparing them against each other. Whereas research that tends to find that there's a cost impact usually doesn't do nearly that rigorous of an analysis.
Can you reiterate why this is important for us to do? And just because there's laws on the books doesn't mean that it's actually being held up or enforced.
It's just any municipality, like the examples that we cited of cases where some of the most egregious behaviors have been discovered and are being prosecuted. Again, they're prominent projects. You know, they're publicly owned projects. There's a lot of scrutiny. Like everyone knew about the Viking Lakes facility that was being built out there, and yet this stuff still happened. So again, there's enough work going on, enough activity in the industry that, you know, some contractors feel that they can skirt by and will not get caught. That's why they do it. So if the city were to choose to put these more enhanced requirements in there, the city would be committing to that role of trying to help weed this sort of behavior out and ensure that taxpayer dollars are being used to support lawful businesses who actually, you know, have employees that they pay fair wages and benefits to, rather than because of low bid requirements and things like that, unintentionally subsidizing companies that are gaming those requirements to cheat. That's really what it ties back to why primarily like our organization's focus is on public sector construction, is because of that hitch with the low bid requirement that essentially is for 100 plus years it's been understood that can be a beacon out there for companies that want to cheat. This is a place to do it if there's not actual meaningful oversight.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Councilmember Buescher, real quick, for item number 3, project labor agreement policy, are they going to be speaking on that as well, or is that...
This is going to be like kind of like a combined situation.
Okay. Yeah. Just want to make sure we have enough time for everybody to speak.
Thank you.
In case we have to do it twice, but it sounds like the third one is the discussion portion. Okay.
Well, good evening, everybody. Flattered to be here to have this discussion. Thank you for having the discussion. My name is Woodrow Piner. I'm with the Northern Midwest Regional Council of Carpenters. Been on staff for 11 years. The primary part of my job is working with law enforcement, bringing cases forward of worker exploitation, misclassification, all of those fun things. Anyway, I'm going to tell you a story about a different city. I moved from West St. Paul to Brooklyn Park, and I used to, you know, go to job sites and talk to workers. And what I noticed in Brooklyn Park on TIF projects was the amount of exploitation and lawbreaking below the gutter, subcontractors that were operating there. Just like West St. Paul, I got involved with the city government there. There was a project with a large GC developer, much like Lion and Trident, a lot like Roars, who had been just moved into town, had been using subcontractors who were exploiting workers. They wanted $3.5 million of TIF money for that project. We were able to actually bring workers forward who had been exploited and savaged to give testimony on that project before the TIF money was awarded. The city bravely took the TIF money away which that building went from 5 stories to 3. But the tax dollars that were, you know, the constituents wasn't funding exploitation. So the city had a lot of concerns, and doing that kind of action, taking TIF money away, is a risky thing for a city council member. And they were really concerned about it, so they wanted to talk about different ideas about putting preventative measures in place. Their first step was a clawback language that was adopted to all TIF projects, where if there was labor exploitation or, you know, any things of that matter found on that project, where the city could actually go in and retract the money. And that was step one, right? That was important, but they had bigger things in mind. And 3 years ago, they did adopt a prevailing wage policy attached to all TIF money. And I have one example, a really good one. Real Estate Equities is a large multifamily developer who has a reputation of operating in the outskirts of the Twin Cities, hiring subcontractors with egregious public records. Phase one of Decatur was done prior to the prevailing wage piece. Mr. Nelson Lopez, who I got paperwork on here, he was operating underneath the primary. He was charged with workers' comp premium fraud. This kind of a guy, a worker, got shot himself in the eye with a nail, but instead of having a workers' comp policy, he was having him went to basically a witch doctor to rub substances on it, and the eye never healed, and the guy went blind. And then when he wanted to come public, he was fearing for his life. A worker nonprofit took him in, where he actually came forward, and that case got charged out. Phase two, prevailing wage was in place. Same GC, a non-union GC, but there were no more contractors like that on that site. That's one city. And why not Ramsey, right? I got here a little bit early today. I used to cover this area for projects, driving over by Affinity and Skyline over here, and two GCs built those projects, but with the same wood frame subcontractor who I have public documentation on here with me. I can share all that with you. Mr. Nelson Lopez is one of them that I shared. Another individual by the name of Mr. Humberto Rangel Torres. He was found guilty of sex trafficking of minors to workers as a form of payment. He worked underneath the upper tier sub. I got that documentation with me here today. Really great fellow. Another interesting guy who performed work over here, his name is Faustino Constante. He was found in violation with the Minnesota Department of Labor. One of his workers wasn't getting paid, so he came forward just looking to be made whole. And what he got was a threat on his life and his 8-year-old daughter's life. So these are the kind of actors who live on these projects. I said it's when you think about what's happening to the workers, and these guys laid it out really well, no business can compete with this kind of business model. If you're being exploited, if you're being trafficked, if your form of payment is underage women instead of getting paid, what does that tell you? Anyway, I brought some stuff here. Hope you don't mind. You guys cool with some handouts?
Yes.
I didn't make enough, so you might have to share a few.
You want me to pass them out, Woody?
All right. Pass these down. Just warning, there's some graphic images in here. When you look at them.
I just want to document.
When you open them up, I'll pass these documents around as well. The first picture, let's see. You guys see the warning there. The first picture is a text message from a group of workers that were just wanting to get paid. They hadn't been paid for weeks. And they were coming into our office just to, like, maybe help them file a lien. And what they got for a reward was text messages of showing people being opened inside out, and basically this is what was told is going to be happening to their families. I can't recite the Spanish that's in that text message, but that's what happened when they just wanted to be made whole, is their families back in El Salvador or whatever, whose life wasn't worth spit to the labor broker. That was the threat, was you better shut up or this is what's going to happen to your family back home. Picture number two, I believe it shows a woman with a bullet hole in her arm. There was a group of workers on a project in Minneapolis. Same kind of scenario. Hadn't been paid for weeks. The dad and the mom, who were performing drywall inside of the building, finally confronted the broker and the company and actually went to the city of Minneapolis And for them opening their mouth on Good Friday 3 years ago, the labor broker showed up in the upper floor of the apartment, riddled the apartment full of bullets, and the 13-year-old girl sleeping on the couch had a bullet go through her arm. And that was just trying to be made whole, right? Third picture, I believe it shows an individual who had fallen to his death. Why I bring that up, Wolf was once again the primary subcontractor on this project. This poor gentleman was three tiers of subcontractors down. Obviously no safety was taking place. The handrail failed, and he fell to his death from three stories. And the really sad about this poor Mr. Guasco is that his body sat in a cooler in Dakota County for roughly 3 weeks because nobody knew who to claim him. Finally, somebody did. So these are real stories. And my last picture I have here is one of the most notorious labor brokers in town. He moves in and out. Mr. Eduardo Valenzuela is his name. When workers go to collect payments, they would go to a trailer where he would have a gun pointed, you know, by their head as they would collect their payments. And anybody who would complain, workers would just disappear. So it's I don't mean to bring the grime and the grit to this, but it's a really sad story, and I'm really just thrilled to have another city at least having the conversation about it. I've been part of these conversations. I've seen some really good things happen. Cities can get creative with it, but I'll take any questions.
All right. We've got about a half hour. Bush, Councilmember Bush.
So you mentioned Roars and Lion, whose also name is Trident.
Yep.
Are those companies that are currently building in our city?
They will be. I actually brought the criminal complaint from Anthony had mentioned the wage theft case, the $1.28 million. On page 7 and 8, it actually lists the projects on the criminal document where the wage theft happened. In here, I can pass this around or even send it out. The Beyond Apartments at 236 Settlers Ridge Parkway, Woodbury. That was Aurora's development. On page 8, Havenwood of Maple Grove, which isn't too far away. That's also mentioned in the criminal document. That's also Aurora's project. So it's they're documenting all this stuff now, right? So it's not just a mystery. And I think a lot of cities are becoming more well-educated about this kind of a thing because TIF money is important, and we want it to go to the right place. And funding a plantation type of mentality of going to work is something that people don't want to fund.
All right. In the interest of time, any other questions before we move on?
Thank you, Woody.
Okay.
Thank you.
You good?
In the interest of time, they've stated what we need to say.
Sir?
I'm just here in support. I say just a couple of things. Dealing with the Boilermakers, I appreciate you letting me sit in front of you. I'm just here in support. We're at the Boilermakers. We're just up the road in Ramsey. We're talking about fair wages. We're talking about labor. I'm pro-labor. I'm in a union. When I say pro-labor, that doesn't mean I want everybody to be union. I want the workers of this community to get a fair shake. And that's what I'm here to support. It's just making sure that those that are working in our community with us are getting treated the way they should be. So I don't have anything prepared. I'm just here as a support. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming.
All right. For that portion, it looks like everybody's had a chance to speak. Councilmember Bisher, what's your thoughts on what you're asking for wage theft enforcement, or do you want to move into the project claimer agreement policy?
I think what was discussed covers both topics. I think next would be maybe asking consensus on having our city attorney craft a policy in the best way that we see fit.
Okay, does anybody have any thoughts before we move forward with that? Yes.
Thank you. I think I need better understanding of what we just reviewed here today. I don't feel that there's enough information to like go into all of this in a way that I think. Anyway, Especially this Brooklyn Park clawback, somebody said, or crawback, or
clawback.
Something like clawback on the tip. I'm hyper interested in that one. I don't understand. I guess, again, all this information is fresh and super brand new to me, at least. And so I would like more of a discussion on what we've actually doing with number three. I think this bitter prevailing wage thing is one of our tools, but what do these other tools look like? What are they? Can we get more information on that before we make decisions on these is what I want, if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Good.
Eric.
Brian, do we have something built into the contracts that can call back TIF already?
I don't think we've utilized anything related to these topics. The one that's kind of the most common that I can think of is related to job creation or kind of valuation thresholds.
That, like for zero zone.
Yeah. Yeah. Oftentimes we tie TIF. The main tool we tie it to is job creation, and add a certain threshold above that and whatnot. We go through the financial analysis as far as kind of making sure that the developer doesn't become unduly rich, or however the terminology is exactly. But yeah, not, I don't think that we've used anything like this.
With these five options, sounds like there might be a sixth, if I'm understanding what you're saying, which the city could own. So we have stipulations for clawbacks if they don't meet certain thresholds, like we talked about for hiring practices and things of that nature. Could we add a stipulation saying if they're found guilty of any unfavorable criminal practices during construction, that would add something of that nature?
It sounds like from what was shared, there's some resources available for that, except the provisions we use now are more post-construction business operation, mm-hmm. not construction phase.
Right. But I'm saying if there was a contractor who used individuals and kept their money, there was wage theft, and there was trafficking and things of that nature, could we put a provision in the contract saying if they're found guilty for any of that stuff, then there would be recourse?
Yeah, it sounds like there's language used in other entities.
So you're saying
I haven't
yes.
personally seen it, but.
Yeah.
Additional questions? Kristen?
I like that path of thinking. I think I would like to take it a step further and say that they can't use anyone that has any open claims. So even if they haven't been found guilty yet, if there's anything open.
The issue with that, from what I understand, is that contractors will use subcontractors, and those subcontractors will be found of doing bad things. Those contractors, I would hope, would no longer use those subcontractors. So if they find out post-project that some of their subcontractors were doing something wrong, and they decided, that's terrible, we're never going to use them again, than to box them out from any future projects while their subcontractor has a legal claim against them seems not fair.
Can I check with the guys? Do you guys know of anyone that does that?
There are some provisions like that in the Minnesota Responsible Contractor Law. I don't have them memorized, I apologize on that, but there are some things on there that if you meet certain conditions about like past cases, I think it's within the last 3 years or so, then you are deemed not a responsible contractor under the Minnesota RCL. But I can't quote it for you.
But you guys have seen contractors use other groups that have previously had cases. Yeah, right? So like
all the time.
Okay. So it's not just because they get a case one time that people will stop using them.
Correct.
Mike.
Fingers right. What goes into determining a responsible bid? Is there anything about this kind of behavior that would factor into that?
So there's two ways to, in public bidding, right? It's lowest responsive bidder, and there is case law on both sides in terms of what you can put in for the types of things that you're looking for as a responsive bidder. And then there's the best value alternative bidding, and that is where, I don't want to say the sky's the limit, but there is a much broader opportunity for you to build out all of the different things that you would be looking for in terms of it's not just about the cheapest amount. It can be years of experience. It can be types of projects done. All, you know, whatever you might think of, you can put in there, and then you have a scoring that's related to that. So instead of it just being the dollar number, it's you score all of those things. The person with the best score would be your most, that's who you're going with. So you still have a formula that gets you to a person that you have to choose. So those are the two ways to get to a contractor under the public bidding law. Generally, there's nuance there, but let's just go with that for now. So in terms of what we have in that first bucket of just the lowest, that's limited. Did that answer your question? Sort of.
So theoretically, because I work with school districts all over the nation that write RFPs, there are stipulations sometimes where we'll say, like, do you have any legal cases filed against you or any of your subcontractors? And they have to answer yes or no. We could add that into our bids, and then if they do have a case against them or some of the contractors, they'd have to answer yes and explain. And we could take that into consideration when we do our bid evaluation matrix to see, because what you're saying, essentially, it's a weighted scale. You could say there's 60 points goes to the lowest bidder, there's 10 points that goes to the best references, there's 10 points that goes to city preference.
Yes.
There's 10 points that goes towards, if you checked yes or no towards this box.
Yes.
And then they take the amalgamation of all that data and they say, based on our matrix, this is the best value, not necessarily the best, the lowest price, but the best value bid.
Right. Yes.
So that's something that we could add into
Yes.
RFPs going forward.
So the best value contracting is a little bit different in terms of the process. So if that's something the council wanted to look at employing versus just the straight line number, that would require some, I would want to defer to Bruce and to engineering in terms of how do you do the projects now to make sure that we're not creating, you know, an extra 60 days of time or something that we haven't budgeted for in the project to make sure that we've got the right documents built out so it can maintain the same timeline as the traditional bidding process. Because a lot of these projects have a very short construction window season.
Shanna?
I think I'd be pro hearing more about that piece, and then I guess that kind of did open up the can of worms that I was thinking about going all these road construction pieces that we've been doing, like that for the paving and all that stuff. How are we making sure that those folks currently are actually being paid for what we're paying them, like through this?
We're not checking payroll.
No, we don't check payroll. But we rely on state statutes. There's responsible contractor, responsible subcontractor statutes out there, and we follow those and follow all of the, basically the MnDOT specs and utilize those that kind of help safeguard us against those kinds of things. But we do not do audits. Unless there's prevailing wages, then we'll go out and do interviews and ask workers what they're being paid as needed, but other than that, we don't do that.
I think there's a fine balance between ensuring that work that happens in Ramsey is done ethically, that there's no human trafficking, labor trafficking, or I guess sex trafficking and labor trafficking are both forms of human trafficking. I think that's honorable and something that we should talk about. And I do appreciate all the members of the union. I'm not a union person personally, but I understand there are benefits to having both union and non-union. What I don't want to see is a barrier for entry for ethical contractors that are not union to not be able to do work because there are certain benchmarks that they maybe can't reach. If these are all very easy to comply with and it shows transparency that they're working with the right people, I'm all for it. There are small businesses that, and you guys all do a great job representing your organizations. Unions are very large. They have a very good good team of professionals and legal experts that work together to ensure that there are favorable work policies. But just because a small contractor doesn't have that same team to come together and present all of this stuff doesn't mean that they're unethical and that they can't do good work. So I would be in favor of finding common sense things that we can use that we can hold everybody to. What I'm not in favor of is creating a front-end environment that blocks out non-union workers for competing for positions. I don't think that's the city's position. And I have a question for Brian, and then I'll open for questions here. But Councilmember Buescher, you said that it wouldn't cost the city anything extra to enforce any of this. I think that's what you said. Sounds like there would be a lot of work and time, staff time, if we decide to start checking payrolls of every business that's working here and auditing labor agreements and things of that nature. Would it truly not cost us any extra time or money, or is this something that would have a big impact on our budget and we'd have to hire people to enforce a lot of this stuff?
I can't answer that with certainty, but it sounds like at least when there's prevailing wage, engineering's doing a little bit of extra work, interviewing staff members on the project. I know whenever we get state or federal dollars financed, there's extra paperwork, reporting requirements involved, so it won't not add any time. I just don't know how much time it would add. I'd have to go and talk to other cities to see what they have experienced too. I think Brooklyn Park is one that was mentioned. You know, I can chat with them to see what they have experienced on a kind of an average project standpoint. But
yes, to summarize what I think unfair labor practices, unfair would be an understatement, but we'll just say unfair labor practices is not good for anybody. Creating an environment where ethical contractors who are not part of a union cannot compete for business is something that I would not like to do. So if it's implementing those questions in an RFP and asking, have you ever, and do you plan to continue, and even maybe having some stipulations based on if you're convicted after, or if you're tied to a conviction afterwards, I think that'd be a great way to keep people from working with bad companies, because there's a financial cost to it. But then it would allow everybody to compete on projects as long as they're doing so ethically. I think that's where I stand on this. Anybody else? Kirsten?
I'm not going to let perfection get in the way of progress, and I think that's starting somewhere. I don't think it's good enough. I still think that we should maybe have another sit down with folks to talk about those five other options. And you know, see how that would work, especially that clawback. We have TIF going into one of the projects built by a group that we just heard, right? So that's city funding going to a group that has been known to have issues, and we're okay with that money going to them no matter what they do right now, right? And so I don't think that this is good enough, but I will say that I'm comfortable moving forward with that limited scope, and I would like to see folks come back to talk further. I also want to like recognize the fact that the union represents smaller businesses. So, you know, it can be a member org with three people, and I don't think that any of these are a barrier to entry for smaller groups. If you guys, do you have any, you know, examples of how this could be a barrier to smaller orgs, or you guys have smaller orgs within your org?
Companies that have two employees.
Yeah.
Doing single family homes, so it's likewise.
Yeah. So I definitely wouldn't want to see us, you know, restricting small businesses from being able to be here. And I mentioned up front that, you know, anything that we did would need to be that non-union shops could get in there too. So, and I will say that the cost / work staff time thing was more of a question, but it sounded like maybe we are doing more than is required of us when there is prevailing wages, which could be the reason that it also is taking us more time, right? Our requirement is just to get the documentation. It's not necessarily for us to personally audit. Was that right, Tim?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So
we're not auditing. But it sounds like part of the requirement of that is to do an interview.
Correct.
Okay. So, go ahead. What?
And I think that's a DOT requirement to do a worker interview.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think that there's room for us to continue these conversations. I know it was a lot to take in at first, so sorry for that. But yeah, if we're all open to having continued conversations on this, I think that's important. But start with what we can agree on and move forward.
So yeah, so in a spirit of friendship and unity and all that stuff, and then more I'm being serious, but and then to be even more serious about making sure that we don't have unsafe labor practices, would the council entertain giving staff direction to look at a few options of how we could better increase labor practices that would equally affect both union shops and non-union shops, and bring those to us at a later date with some information of what we could do to do that? I think everybody's in favor of a safe city that combats human trafficking, and I think there's a way that everyone can move towards that through some shared agreements. So, does that make sense? Is that the consensus? All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you. Appreciate you for coming and all your input. And I think it's good information that you shared. Thank you. All right. We're going to have a big meeting here at 7, so let's kind of hop through these next ones. Item number 3, so everybody can have a bathroom break and talk to whoever they need to beforehand. But topics of future discussion. You guys see that? We've got the future topics list and the requests. Chris, did you raise your hand?
Well, I mean, just a correction here. We've got 825 listed twice for the budget. Super important, but I don't think we can spend 3 hours talking about it.
Hopefully we're through the brunt of it by then.
All right, we'll make an adjustment there. Updates on outside committees. I think if everybody's okay, we can do that next meeting. Okay. All right, then if there's nothing else, then we will adjourn and see everybody at 7 o'clock.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Sure.
Any DNA?
Not that I'm aware of.
What was that?
Might have my fingerprints on it.
That's
Did I leave that there again?
That's the perfect crime. Put your own fingerprints on it and say,
"Move, Olson."
Oh, I've contaminated the crime scene and eliminated myself as a suspect. No, no. Where did you find that?
Michael,
oh, it's
on the street.
So we got recording. Great, right? All on recording. Yep.